Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live, the live audio program brought to you by ReaderViews.com. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I'm talking with J.L. Gibson, former elementary school teacher turned fiction writer. J.L. is here today to talk with us about her Ancient Mirrors book series and the recently published second installment, The Reckoning. Now, before we begin, I'd like to tell you a little more about this delightful author. J.L. Gibson was born in California, where she spent much of her young life. As a child, she listened to her grandmother tell stories of traditional Celtic folklore and fairy tales, which would later influence her in the direction of her own writing and storytelling. With a Bachelor of Arts and a Master's in Multicultural Studies, J.L. became an elementary school teacher in 1989. However, her passion for storytelling and research into Celtic and Anglo-Saxon cultures proved more enticing than grade school instruction, and she retired from teaching in 2003 to pursue writing full-time. The seedlings of her grandmother's Celtic legends, combined with the alternate world she harbored in her own mind, form the Ancient Mirrors Tales book series. In addition, J.L. is the creator of the popular Writer's Workshop, From Brainstorm to Book and Beyond, and has authored numerous nonfiction articles. J.L. resides in Southern Oregon with her husband and often attends conventions and conferences. She can be found annually at Book Expo America, Wordstock, Fairy Worlds, and as a speaker at Oregon South Coast Writers Conference. She is currently working on her next novel, and I'm just so delighted to have J.L. on the phone today. Welcome to Inside Scoop Live, J.L.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. Thank you.
That is quite an interesting bio, and I didn't even mention your exotic pets, the sugar gliders and the Moluccan cockatoo.
Oh, yes. I do have some odd pets.
Well, I would love for you to tell us a little bit about your interest in Celtic folklore and the fantasy stories that permeated your life and since childhood.
Well, my grandmother was an Irish Celt, and for her the fairy faith was very real. And I was the little girl who sat on the stool beside her while she rolled out pie crust. And the whole time she just would tell tales. And they were tales of gods and goddesses, but they were also tales of mortals who struggled every day to attain the unattainable. And my grandmother had this magical touch. She always twisted a story to make sure that the main character was a young girl, or as I grew a little older, a teenager, or a woman. And so that's one reason that I do focus on strong female characters in my novels. It was spoon-fed to me at a very early age. I don't know how familiar you are with Celtic tales, but they're broken down into three different categories: adventures, voyages, and folk tales. So they just lend themselves beautifully to the fantasy genre. And I can't imagine writing anything else.
Oh, that's great. Now, why don't you tell us about the Ancient Mirrors book series? What is it all about?
The Ancient Mirrors series is a four-book series that focuses on friendships and loyalties and the power that lies within us all. It's taken from a woman's perspective. The main characters are women, though there are plenty of men, and dragons abound in the stories. It's a story of loss and rediscovery. In the initial story, Dragon Queen, a woman awakens. She's actually awakened, summoned from the sleep of death. And she awakens on a world she doesn't recall to discover that she basically has been betrayed and abandoned by everyone that she knew. And she finds that she is the heir to the Dragon Queen throne. And her job is to bring that shattered world of the Seven Kingdoms back together. The second story, The Reckoning, takes her niece, the niece of the queen, who is a very rebellious young woman. And this story has become very, very popular with the teens. They love the high action that this story has. And, of course, the first book has a lot of world building in it, and it's not quite as action-driven as the second story.
Okay.
But it takes Quinn, the niece of the queen, who is rebellious and just really doesn't accept authority. She feels like that authority will stifle her, and even though she is trained as a guardian, she's not restricted by the rules of guardianship of the world, and so she's seen as a rogue and a thief and a ne'er-do-well, and the rest of her family isn't too fond of her behavior. However, when they need somebody to perform a task that requires stealth, she's the one who's chosen for that quest. And so the story unfolds as she sets out on a quest to recover the wreck and worm shards that could reactivate an ancient army and perhaps destroy Dragmoor once more.
Okay, that's so interesting. Now, I originally thought that this was just basically a children's book series, but this can transfer over to young adult and adult.
Oh, yeah, yes. In fact, I, like many authors, when I wrote it, it was a story in my head, and so I wrote it. I didn't intend it to be for young adults or for children or adults. It was just a story that, in the end, was what it is. When it was first published, it actually was the publisher who said, this crosses over between adults and young adults. And as it moved out into the market and into public libraries, I noticed that in the libraries it was on both shelves. And I asked my local librarian about that, and she said, oh, well, I put it on the young adult shelves, but I had to put it on the adult shelves as well because the adults were taking it from the young adults.
Oh, is that
right? So that's when the truth really hit, that it really is a book for everybody. There's nothing in it that's not acceptable for anyone who's 11 or above. And my youngest readers have been 11 and 12-year-olds who are really strong readers. Mm-hmm. Of course, my youngest professional reviewer was your very own Ian. And he's 13.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed him so much because he's so honest.
Oh, yes, he is.
And I was so validated because his review said exactly what I would have expected. You know, he liked the action of the second book better than the world building of the first, and yet so many adults prefer the first book.
Okay.
My editor, that's her favorite book. So.
Oh, is that right?
You just never know, and it's nice to appeal to lots of people.
Absolutely.
So, now, it definitely crosses over.
Oh, that's great. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about the portrayal of strong women in fantasy and science fiction. It seems to be on the rise right now. And, you know, as you mentioned, your main character in The Reckoning, Quen, she's a very strong woman. So what are your thoughts on portraying strong women in Celtic literature, and how are the struggles of these women in a different time period comparable with women today?
Well, I think that they probably are quite unrealistic if we do the comparison, because the time period of history, we did have strong women. There were very strong women who rose to power. However, they were often beheaded or burned at the stake, and I didn't want my characters to end that way. So I take great license with that period of history. I think that publishers, of course, are looking for what works commercially, and with a fantasy focus on women, you open the door for a broader readership rather than a narrower readership, contrary to a lot of romance novels. Both men and women, and boys and girls, enjoy strong women characters. They don't seem to be put off by them at all. After all, what's not to love about a strong, beautiful woman who can also handle a bit of action and adventure?
Of course.
You know, she's the character for everyone. I wanted my characters to be characters that younger readers could identify with, teenagers particularly. I think they need strong role models, even if they're not in the real world. There are certain things that cross over between men and women, and there are certain things that everybody's looking for in a hero, honorable qualities such as courage and strength and truth. They aren't masculine or feminine. Instead, they just represent the best of both sexes, the best of what's humanity. And that's what I wanted in my characters. And Quinn, the main character in The Reckoning, is very much a woman, young woman, and yet she is strong, and she finds within herself some qualities that she didn't even know existed. And I think that that's true for a lot of us growing up. We see ourselves one way, and then a particular event will show us that there's more to us than even we realize. And so those were things that I was looking for in my strong women characters. Quinn's very stubborn, and when I say stubborn, I mean it in a very nice way for Quinn.
Yeah.
Kind of when the situation has gone through 10 times of hopelessness and the bad guys are absolutely certain to win, stubborn is that attitude that won't lie down and die. It's that quality that makes the legend that will outlast the empire. And so that's our Quinn.
Mm. So there is an element of self-discovery and deeper, just deeper issues in this book.
Yes, and Quinn actually is the character who has a part in 3 out of the 4 books.
Oh.
And she really surprised me. She goes on into the 4th book, which is Quantum, and it's at the publishers now, just to truly amaze me. And I've been told that when the characters amaze the author, that's a good sign. So I was absolutely just blown away by Quinn in the 4th novel.
So you don't have, when you sat down to write this book series, you didn't have a particular direction started?
Oh,
and point?
I did.
Oh, you did?
Mm-hmm. I did. In fact, I'm an outliner.
Okay.
And I discovered very early on when I started writing that you can write 100 pages that will go nowhere.
Mm.
I have this wonderful beginning, 100 pages, and it dawned on me, that's great, it sounds super, but where is it going? It had nowhere to go.
Mm.
And even though I have plenty of time, I don't want to waste it. So I'm an outliner. I want to see the end before I begin. And I write very detailed outlines. However, the characters just never will stay within that outline. And that's what Quinn did to me in the 4th novel in Quantum. She just was so much more than as a writer I would have allowed her to be if I had allowed myself to control her too tightly. And so sometimes characters just have minds of their own.
That's what I hear from a lot of writers. That's very interesting. Now, your series has been somewhat compared to Tolkien mythology. Would you elaborate on that and maybe mention some of the influences classic fantasy has had on your writing?
Well, as far as Tolkien goes, I think that there are elements of my writing that are Tolkien-like. However, you won't find any orcs or elves or any of the highly recognizable Tolkien characters in my stories, and I did that very deliberately with the release of the Tolkien Lord of the Rings movies. So many writers jumped on the bandwagon, and we have just this flood of books about elves, and elves are absolutely wonderful. I love them.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided I wouldn't write elves. Everybody else did. And so I stepped away from Tolkien. So in that way, he truly was my model of what not to do.
Okay.
But I didn't want to be another Tolkien carbon copy. And so I stayed away from those highly recognizable characters that make up the Tolkien world.
Mm.
And he's just absolutely one of my very favorites. In fact, I just finished reading The Children of Húrin with the Realms of Fantasy book club group. And Dragon Queen is actually paired with The Children of Húrin on Amazon through July.
Oh, wow.
And so I just absolutely think he is the king of fantasy.
Yeah.
The other thing that I wanted to do is give strength to my women characters that Tolkien didn't. And when we look at the movies,
mm-hmm.
women are very strong.
Mm-hmm.
That was marketing.
Is that right?
And if you read the books, you know that wasn't true, okay? Eowyn and Arwen were just passing mentions in the books. They didn't play those really strong roles that they played in the movies. And I think the movies were richer because of it.
Mm.
And for modern young women, and men too, the movies really worked. And I think they might not have worked as well if they had followed Tolkien's idea of women. So you are seeing that change a lot. And I think for my particular characters and for most fantasy authors who are writing strong women, what we're writing is kind of a quasi-medieval idea of knighthood with a feminine twist.
That works.
We are looking at those qualities that we saw in the written account, the Arthurian legends, of the knighthood, which historically was probably very, very different. But in the Arthurian legends, knighthood was just something that we put up on a pedestal, and they were just the best of the best. And that's what I wanted in my female characters. But with that feminine twist, with that different mentality that separates the sexes. Women's mentality, I think, is in the way they handle certain situations very different. And that's what makes it's so nice. It makes the genders work very well together.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think we are seeing a rise on women as strong characters in fantasy. I know that Nora Roberts, who is predominantly, I think, a romance writer, had a book out that was very fantasy. I mean, shape-shifting and elves and the whole gamut that just did really well. And I think women authors are stepping out more than they used to.
Mm-hmm.
In fantasy. So it's not just the characters. I think it's also new women authors on the fantasy forefront.
That's great. That's great to see that in all genres on
it
the
is.
Bookshelf.
It really is.
Absolutely. So, Jill, what are your thoughts on the faith aspect of your book series that kind of comes out of the Celtic and fantasy backdrop? It seems like there really is an inspirational theme. Can you talk a little bit to that?
Well, there he is. Excuse me. There he is. And it's based on the fairy faith, the original Celtic fairy faith. And for people who are really interested in the fairy faith, I would recommend The Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries by W.Y. Evans-Wentz. He does an absolutely wonderful job at going into great detail about the fairy faith in Celtic countries. The faith that I build throughout the stories is based on the old fairy faith, without the fairies.
Okay.
It's tied to nature directly, and it looks within each character for their strengths and their weaknesses. And that was something that I knew that each individual person who reads the books would see in themselves. And so that's threaded throughout all four books. It becomes very, very evident in the final book of the Ancient Mirror series in Quandam. It really is obvious there, much more so than it is in the first three novels.
Mm. Okay, so it is very relatable.
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. Yes. I, of course, drew on my teenage years and my growing up, and I was a pretty average kid growing up, with the exception of my grandmother, who was probably pretty special.
Mm.
Not everybody had one of those.
Yes. That's great. Now, Jill, I know that you're very involved with role-playing games and video gaming, and that has really significantly influenced your writing. Would you tell us a little bit about how you became involved and your involvement now? From what I hear, you're quite an expert in this area.
I've been playing role-play games since Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh,
pencil
wow.
And paper game, and that was, I think, in 73. In fact, at Book Expo America, I hung out at the Wizards of the Coast booth. So
okay.
I've always been drawn to the role-play aspect of gaming. And the nice thing about role-play games is that they are storytelling. Storytelling is what a role-play game is about. wizards and dragons, knights, elves, aliens, military action, horror, historical simulation, or modern-day life, like The Sims. It doesn't matter. It's all about storytelling. And that's the element of role-play gaming that has influenced me so strongly in my writing. It, as you role-play online or in a game that's a single-player game, you are constantly evolving as the character that you play, the playable character. And you can't help but build a story around those characters. Two of the characters in the Ancient Mirrors series, Talon and Nahl, both of those are actually based on characters created for role-play games by a friend of mine, which is why his name is always mentioned in the front of the books. I borrowed his characters. They're great. And of course, I twisted them and changed them, and he laughs and says he'd never recognize them. They're not purple or anything anymore. But but the thing is, they were just these really strong male role models,
mm-hmm.
and they were the kind of men I wanted in my stories. And so he and I worked together on Dragon Queen in the beginning, and he also worked with me on The Reckoning, and now he's just kind of a bounce feedback for me.
Oh, wow.
But I met him playing games.
So, oh, that's incredible.
It's played a really, really strong role in my writing and in my life. You know, PC games and console games get such a bad rap, and it's often from people who don't play games. Games can involve a great number of skills. That transfer into real life, and there are so many genres that even if you don't like fantasy and role play, there are just so many games. I mean, everything from an action adventure to a management game like Zoo Tycoon or racing like Gran Turismo and Grand Prix, simulations. You know, everything from model trains, 3D and flight simulator to The Sims. It's just this incredible opportunity to use your imagination, and that's the part that I like so much, is it stretches the imagination, and now I use them for brain breaks. I used to play games 6, 8, sometimes 10 hours a day. So now I have separate computers. I have a gaming computer, and I have my writing computer.
Your work computer.
That's right, and the gaming computer does not turn on until the day's writing is over, because I just disappear into a game.
Yes.
And I use it for brain breaks.
Mm-hmm.
If I get stumped or things aren't going the way I want them to and my characters are just really out of control and misbehaving, I just walk away from it, and I'll go play a game. And you know, Hour of Tomb Raider just gets you right on task.
Gets you right back.
You're ready. You know, you go out and fight a few velociraptors and a Tyrannosaurus Rex, and you win, and you just feel so powerful, so you can go back to work.
Talk about the negative side of video gaming, though, you really bring a more positive element to it. And I'd like you to talk also a little bit towards the possibility of gaming as an educational tool.
I was one of those teachers who just had to try everything. And so as part of a project back in 2001, I used gaming in my classroom as a teaching tool. And what I was looking for were games that would ease the stress of doing something that's timed, because the new state mandated tests are all timed, and kids just freak out. They just they panic. I had fifth graders crying because they couldn't complete a task in the allotted time. Well, we know that the test is designed so most students can't finish.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one aspect I was looking at. I wanted kids to be doing things that were timed on a regular basis, so that when it said, "Oh, you only have so many minutes," it wasn't so scary. One of the other things I wanted to do was teach puzzle-solving skills, because those cross over into all kinds of subject areas in school. And so one of the games that I used was the Myst series, which is benign. It takes place on a series of alien worlds, but it's a benign game. There's no fighting in it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I used this as a team-building tool as well. I divided my kids up into teams, and then they tried to solve the puzzles in the Myst games. Well, most adults can't solve the missed puzzles by themselves. They have to go online and get help from other people. And it was the best team-building activity I ever used in my entire career. It's amazing how kids will come together, and all those brains will work to solve a puzzle and get a frog out of a well. That was one that just...
Oh, that's incredible.
I've never forgotten that one. It was in the game Riven, which is part of that series, and you had to get this little frog out of the well. And you had to push levers and turn knobs and push buttons and in a certain order.
Mm-hmm.
And to watch those kids, I mean, they were leaned up over their desk.
That's fascinating.
And looking and talking and drawing diagrams and color-coding things about what we've already done and what we need to do next. And there are so many elements in games that are similar to that it is a shame not to use that technology. And I am not saying that we should take World of Warcraft and play it in the classroom.
Sure.
You know, there are aspects to World of Warcraft that are great and skill building, but it's not the kind of game that lends itself toward an educational setting.
Mm-hmm.
But the game developers have the technology, and I think that as educators, it's really foolish of us not to use it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's great about a game is it is ability leveled. It's built into the game. So when you play a game, it's you choose the level, and it's not going to be so hard that it frustrates you or so easy that you get bored, which is a real problem with kids in a classroom. When a teacher has 20 or 30 kids in her classroom, and I'm being kind, I often have 33.
So that's a lot when
you have that many kids and that many different learning styles,
mm-hmm,
and abilities, that sort of a setup is just a real blessing for a teacher, and it's available. It's available, so I think we need to use it. And if we look at some of the skills that are available in games, action-adventure games, which are probably the least likely to just fall into a classroom setting, but something like Tomb Raider and Half-Life, those games require problem-solving skills, information retention while you explore imaginary and real worlds. It's real life in a game.
Mm-hmm.
And those are skills that we want in adults.
Absolutely.
We want those skills. If you look at a management game, they're based completely on creating a business involving the player in the use of skills like critical thinking and math to build a virtual business, but you still have to end up in the black so you can pay workers and buy your supplies.
Mm.
It's everyday life in a game.
There you go. Well, Dale, I can't believe it, but our time is actually coming to an end here. This has been such a fascinating and interesting interview, but I just wanted you to mention your website and where readers can get more information on you and your book.
Definitely drop by the website, ancientmirrors.com.
Okay.
The name of the series, ancientmirrors.com. And stop by regularly because we've got a contest coming up for a new slogan, and it has great prizes, Barnes & Noble gift certificates, Amazon.com gift certificates, EB Games gift certificates.
Oh, great.
So that'll be coming up in... What month is this? June. July and August.
Okay.
So stop by the website. There will be a link for that as of July 1st.
And your book 3 and book 4, when can readers expect those?
Damselflies is coming out November 1st.
Okay.
And Quantum will be out summer of 2008. I think June is the scheduled release. And they're available wherever books are sold, and there are links to online booksellers from my website, but they're also available in the bookstores. In fact, I think Barnes & Noble just ordered a whole bunch of them.
So. Oh, great. And I just wanted to make sure that readers knew also that if they go to Amazon.com, you have a blog that you've talked and dialogued about your recent book expo adventures, and they can go there to find out more about that.
They can. Amazon is just this wonderfully kind organization that gives their authors a blog and an author page. And so if they go to my profile page on Amazon.com, they will discover links to all the photographs from Book Expos.
Oh, you've got photos up there,
well,
too.
I put photos everywhere.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Photos, recorded interviews, all of that stuff is available. My book trailers are available through my website, ancientmirrors.com. In fact, they're on the homepage, I think, right now. So.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, I just want to offer you maybe the last 30 seconds here to share any final thoughts that you would like to your listeners today.
I'd just like to say how much I appreciate my readers. Mm. I really do, and my favorite part of the entire book business is actually interacting with readers. So I thank them all for listening to the interview and sharing a half hour of their time with me, and I thank you as well.
Oh, well, thank you, Dale. It's been great talking with you. Just one more point. Can people email you through your website? Do you have a contact?
I do have a contact page, and you just click on the contact page, and it's embedded right in the website, so you just leave whatever message you like, and it comes, if it's of a personal nature at all, it'll come directly to me.
Okay.
And then we always have a separate link for games and contests, so that'll be on the front page. Any link to a contest, and then email me through the contact page. I answer every email personally, so
I'd love
to hear from them.
Yes, we certainly encourage readers to contact authors if they've liked their work or have any further questions, because most authors just welcome those kind of comments. So.
Oh, we do. In fact, even if they didn't like it, we welcome those as well. I think we have to know the truth, and we can't please everyone.
Okay. Well, great, Dale. It has been wonderful talking with you, and I hope to talk with you again for Damselflies.
I'm looking forward to that.
Okay. Bye-bye. Have a nice day.
And goodbye to you.
All right, listeners, for The Reckoning and the Ancient Mirrors book series, go to JL's website, ancientmirrors.com. Also,